Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Today's episode is presented by Meta.
A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating worldwide. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
EU Confidential will get started right after this message.
This week's episode is presented by the Croatian presidency of the Council of the EU.
Timely agreement on the entire financial framework for the next 7 years is our priority. In this, the MFF should meet the expectations of all our citizens in all our member states.
I see a strengthened European defence cooperation not as a competition to NATO, but something that can supplement or complement. So a strengthened European pillar within NATO is a formula, in my opinion.
Welcome to EU Confidential, the number one European politics podcast. I'm Andrew Gray, Politico's EU editor, and you just heard Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the former NATO Secretary General and Danish Prime Minister. He gave us a taste of some of the topics that are sure to come up this weekend at the Munich Security Conference, the big global powwow on defence and diplomacy. And we'll bring you a special edition of the podcast from Munich on Sunday evening. But first, we have a packed podcast today. After a very newsy last 7 days across Europe, let's get into it with our podcast panel. Matt Karnichnik's in Berlin. Hi, Matt.
Good evening.
Annabelle Dixon's in London. Hi, Annabelle.
Hello.
And Reem Momtaz is in Paris. Hi, Reem.
Hello.
Okay, so let's start with Germany. Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer is stepping down as leader of the Christian Democrats after a big fandango in the state of Thuringia. The very short version is that her party, the Christian Democrats, voted along with the far-right AfD, the Alternative for Germany, to install a state premier, and that prompted outcry and uproar. The state premier in question from the FDP didn't last long. Kramp-Karrenbauer's authority was undermined in a couple of different ways. She decided to throw in the towel, which means she won't be party leader for much longer, and she will no longer be the presumed successor to Angela Merkel as chancellor. So, Matt, where does it all go from here?
Well, I think people in the party even were pretty shocked by this turn of events on Monday. She doesn't seem to have told very many people, if anybody. So they were kind of caught wrong-footed by it. And she has said she wants to remain head of the party and to kind of guide this process in the coming months. And she suggested that the next candidate for chancellor should also be party leader, and that there should be a vote on this at the next regular party convention, which isn't until December. So, that's quite a long horizon, and it might be unrealistic to think that this question, which has already caused so much upheaval in the party, this question of who's going to lead Germany's largest political party after Merkel steps back, that they can wait almost another year to decide it.
Matt, isn't it a bit unusual that she quit so quickly? I mean, she was just kind of anointed Merkel's successor, and she just seemed to kind of give up from an outsider's perspective at the first sign of resistance or defiance. Is that normal?
No, it's not normal, but the situation that she was in was also not normal, because in the CDU in particular, you hadn't had a situation in recent memory anyway, where the party leader was also not the chancellor. And, Merkel wanted to remain chancellor through the end of this term and agreed, after her own missteps and after the party lost a number of regional elections, she agreed to step down as party leader, and also saw it as a way to kind of guide Kramp-Karrenbauer into this role. But I think at the end of the day, it's also not too surprising if you look back over the past year, where it wasn't just the gaffes, but you could see on many occasions that she just appeared to be sort of out of her depth, number one, and to not really have the strong support of the party itself.
Right. I mean, I think she was elevated very, very quickly. I mean, she was the Saarland state premier for a while. She was this, Merkel seemed to kind of handpick her. Suddenly she was the CDU secretary general. She didn't do that for very long. Suddenly she's the leader of the party. Then they threw in the defense ministry on top of that.
Right. And that was also a contradiction, because originally she said she wanted to only concentrate on running the party. And then last summer, when Ursula von der Leyen stepped down as defense minister to become commission president, Kramp-Karrenbauer raised her hand for that role. And that's one of the most difficult jobs in the German government.
One of the things that amused the British audience was, I think there was a headline in the week, is Germany ready for a male chancellor? That seemed to be the sort of the takeaway from this particular...
Well, they're definitely going to get one now, I would say. That would be my take, looking at the candidates. Matt, do you want to give us a super quick run-through of who's in the frame?
You know, just to be provocative on this question, I wouldn't rule out that the Greens win the next election, especially, you know, with the CDU not really showing its best side recently, or that it's sort of competent to continue to run the government. But it certainly looks like, in terms of the CDU candidates, that a man will get the job. But overall, the male challengers that she had when she got the job, Jens Spahn, who's now health minister, and Friedrich Merz, who's an old Merkel foe, are more conservative and maybe more in line with the traditions of the CDU.
Yeah, well, let's see. The other sort of main name in the frame at the moment is Armin Laschet, the Premier of North Rhine-Westphalia, who would be seen as a kind of more moderate choice.
And a Merkel copy. A male Merkel.
A mini male Merkel. Maybe that will be his nickname. But let's see. We'll see how it all plays out. Good. Well, let's jump ahead now to someone else who's been making news over the past week, and that's the EU's foreign affairs chief, Josep Borrell, who got into trouble after making some remarks that were not seen as terribly complimentary to young climate protesters. He said at an event, "The idea that young people are seriously committed to fighting climate change, we could call it the Greta syndrome, allow me to doubt that. I would like to know if young people demonstrating in Berlin calling for measures against climate change are aware of what such measures will cost them, and if they're willing to lower their living standards to offer compensation to Polish miners." And he went on a bit in that vein. Annabel, let's bring you in here, because I think this highlights a dilemma in terms of how a lot of politicians are thinking about how they deal with this movement that's emerged over the past couple of years. How do politicians in Britain do it? How does Boris Johnson handle it?
Well, it very much varies. But Boris Johnson is very keen to sort of highlight his green credentials. He announced a load of green crap, as David Cameron termed it a few years ago.
Just crap, singular.
Just crap.
It's the short form. Crap. So great. What David Cameron used to talk about, green crap, that was his attitude.
Yeah, David Cameron used to walk around number 10 saying, "We need to get rid of this green crap."
I thought you were talking about an outhouse or something. Sorry.
Didn't he? Yeah. Well, maybe that's... does that involve his shed?
A privy. You call it a privy.
But wasn't Cameron, you know, at the forefront of trying to kind of, you know, hug a husky and all of that
kind of
stuff?
Well, he was publicly and then privately. But privately, he was sort of frustrated by the constraints of having to hit these targets.
Mm. Reem, what did you make of Borrell's comments?
You know, this may not be very popular to say, but there is common sense in what he's saying. And I say this as someone who has, you know, covered France for the past year. And we've seen that at the heart of the Yellow Jackets movement and protest. At the heart of it, it is about the, you know, who is going to pay for this very important environmental transition that all of these industrialized societies have to actually carry out. And there's definitely a tension between The working classes, the middle classes already feel like they pay a lot of taxes, they don't really get paid very well, and they completely understand and are aware of the, you know, ecological and environmental needs. But at the same time, they say that they're already very stretched thin. So I think he put his hand, perhaps in a way that isn't very politically correct, on a challenge that most Western and European societies are going to have to deal with at one point or another.
Yeah, but I don't know. The thing that struck me, I have to say, was that this was at an event, I think, at the European Parliament last week. And bearing in mind everything that Josep Borrell has is on his agenda, you know, Iran, Syria, the Western Balkans, Libya, the fact that he had time to opine about green climate protesters, I found quite surprising. And I do think that his general persona here at the moment does seem to be that. It seems to have taken on an unofficial role, which is not in the treaties, as the EU's grumpy grandpa. He seems to get quite cranky about various things at various times.
Yeah, but from a journalistic point of view, he's the gift that keeps on giving. Right.
Yeah, well, I just wonder how much longer he can keep on giving and retain his current job, because he does seem to, he's certainly outspoken. And from a journalistic point of view, we should welcome that. So let's leave Josep Borrell there until he gets grumpy about something else, and move on to the Munich Security Conference, which we mentioned at the top of the programme. We'll get a bit of a foretaste of some of those topics from one of our interviews to come. But Annabelle, it looks like the Brits are not going to be there at any kind of senior level or in any kind of great number. Do you have any explanation for that?
Well, the explanation from Downing Street is that Boris Johnson is clashing with Boris Johnson's weekly cabinet meeting. He's actually having a big reshuffle this week. So by the time this goes out, there should be a new look cabinet in place. I do think this is a miscalculation and seems to be kind of part of a trend of not putting these big international conventions sort of top of the list.
Yeah, it's a strange one when Britain, you know, was kind of has always made big play of saying we're leaving the European Union, but we're still committed to Europe's security. So this would have been the showcase for it. And in terms of diary clash, I mean, the event goes on for 3 days. It starts on Friday. It goes on till Sunday lunchtime. So unless he's planning a kind of 3-day cabinet meeting, I would have thought he or somebody else senior could have made it. Reem, did you want to jump in?
On the French side, this is Macron's first time at the Munich Security Conference. And actually, the Élysée told us today that the last French president to have gone was Sarkozy in 2009. So it's been 11 years since there's been a French president at the MSC. Obviously, they're expecting Macron to take a lot of questions on his many headline-grabbing initiatives over the past few months. And so they're expecting it to be, a good time and a good place to do more, as they call it, explaining in order to reassure more and more his partners, who seem to have been quite spooked by his latest interviews and speeches on the matters.
Okay, Matt, what are you expecting from Munich?
Well, one thing that's interesting in all this is that Angela Merkel won't be there, which is, you know, particularly ironic given that this is the first time Macron is gone and that the two of them haven't really.
They just can't seem to quite kind of
eye to eye recently on a lot of
their timing is always off.
Yeah, it's a strange one. Funnily enough, actually, maybe this is a note on which to end, to go back to the beginning. I got in contact with Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer's team a few days ago, end of last week, to ask if we might have an interview at the Munich Security Conference. And the answer came back very quickly that she would not be available. So maybe that was a sign of things to come. We'll leave it there. Matt, Reem, Annabelle, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
And before we get to our feature interviews with Anders Fogh Rasmussen and the new president of the EU's Committee of the Regions, we have a quick message from this week's sponsor.
A message from the Croatian presidency of the Council of the EU.
Timely agreement on the entire financial framework for the next 7 years is our priority. In this, the MFF should meet the expectations of all our citizens in all our member states. So it must continue to finance cohesion and agricultural policies, but also be able to address many new challenges the European Union is facing. It must ensure our togetherness and unity while respecting all of our differences, economic, social and demographic. It must also make Europe more effective and visible on the global stage. To achieve this, we must act fast. We cannot allow delays in the implementation of our EU programs as of 2021. Otherwise, we would be disappointing our citizens. Together with the President of the European Council, who is continuing the MFF talks at the highest political level, we will spare no effort to achieve a breakthrough during our presidency.
And now, our producer Christina Gonzalez caught up with Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the former Danish Prime Minister and Secretary General of NATO. The two met in a bustling hotel lobby on the sidelines of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, a few weeks ago. And Christina starts off by asking the former Secretary General about comments made during the forum by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen.
Europe also needs credible military capabilities, and we have set up the building blocks of a European defence union. It is complementary to NATO, and it is different. There is a European way to foreign policy and foreign security policy, where hard power is an important tool, without any question, but it is never the only one.
Now let's pick up with Rasmussen's reaction and highlights from the rest of their conversation.
As former Secretary General of NATO, how does this statement strike you?
I fully agree. She's right that we need to give the EU stronger capabilities to actively pursue European goals and European values. And if you do not have a military strength, then people will not listen to you. It is as simple as that. But having said that, all speak about a European defense is to think about a paper tiger in the short run, because after Brexit, 80% of all NATO's defense investments will take place outside the European Union. So, in conclusion, I am fully in favor of a strengthened European defense cooperation. But for many, many years, NATO will remain the cornerstone of European security.
And when the European Union says hard power, what does that mean to you?
It means, among other things, troops on the ground. And in that respect, the Europeans have been much too hesitant during recent years. And one example is Syria. If European countries in due time had accepted to send NATO troops to Syria, we could have avoided the mess in Syria, we could have avoided the unilateral Turkish invasion of Syria. So Europe pays the price for its own lack of will and capability to engage in the Middle East.
And what do you think it will take? Do you think now it is at a tipping point and that things will change? Or is this just more talk and rhetoric?
Well, I think Ursula von der Leyen has come off to a good start. So you have to start somewhere. What I'm saying is that the end goal is in a far distance. But you have to start. And I fully agree to build elements of a European defense union. I fully agree to allocate more funds for the European Defense Fund, etc., etc. I'm fully in favor of all efforts to increase European investments in defense and to strengthen European defense cooperation.
Would all NATO allies agree with that?
I don't know, but I see a strengthened European defense cooperation not as a competition to NATO, but something that can supplement or complement what is already done within NATO. So a strengthened European pillar within NATO is a formula, in my opinion.
I'd like to focus specifically on what seems to be an artificial intelligence race between the U.S. and China. Should the U.S. be worried about Chinese AI advancements?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're quite right. We will see an artificial intelligence race. And in the US, they are speaking about a new Manhattan Project, that was the project that led to the nuclear bomb, or a new moon landing project. We're speaking of a challenge in that dimension. And the United States feel committed to be the winner of that race. And I think Europe's role should be to support and cooperate, to support the U.S. and cooperate with the U.S. in that respect. Because if the Chinese and other autocrats are winning this race, then it will undermine the principles and values and standards upon which we have built our free societies. Just think about mandatory face recognition in China. It will provide authoritarian rulers with unprecedented tools to control their own population. And that runs counter to our ideas and our visions. This is the reason why it's of utmost importance that the United States and Europe work and walk hand in hand when it comes to artificial intelligence.
Is that not currently the case?
No, I see worrying signals from certain circles in Europe that they are more focused on creating what they call European champions than they are focused on a fruitful cooperation across the Atlantic. Let's face it, to promote European champions will be to participate in a race that Europe has already lost. If the world's democracies form what I would call a technological alliance of democracies, then we can set our own standards. And it will be very, very difficult for China and Russia just to surpass or overlook those principles and standards.
That was Anders Fogh Rasmussen in conversation with our producer, Christina Gonzalez. Now let's look ahead to another big event looming on the political calendar, a special summit next week on the EU budget. One of the most interested parties in that budget battle is the EU's Committee of the Regions, whose members benefit from a lot of EU funding. Earlier this week, our reporter Lily Beyer caught up with the brand new president of the Committee of the Regions, Apostolos Tsitsikostas, who's also the governor of the Greek region of Central Macedonia. Let's have a listen to their discussion now.
First of all, not all of our listeners are familiar with the European Committee of the Regions. So I was wondering if you could introduce yourself, your region, and also explain a bit about the role of the Committee of the Regions.
Yes, of course. I come from the region of Central Macedonia in Greece. It's the second largest region of Greece with 2 million citizens. It's a really important region because it's located in the northern part of Greece. And I personally am a member of the Committee of the Regions for the last 5 years. And now, with my new function as president, I'm really hoping that I can give a totally different point of view of the Committee of the Regions from the point of view of the other EU institutions as well as from the member states.
So do you see that as really the role of the Committee of the Regions to bring your viewpoint from the ground to Brussels?
Exactly. What we need to do, and this is my main priority at this point for the Committee of the Region, is to bring closer Europe to its citizens. Because this is the major problem that Europe faces at this point. The fact that this institution seems to be far away, distant from the people. And this is exactly what radicalism is using. This is exactly what even member states are using. And we saw Brexit happening a few days ago, which was definitely something that we need to take into serious consideration on what we need to change in Europe in order to make it again an institution that would be important for the people, that people would not feel forgotten or excluded from Brussels and the European Union.
Here in Brussels, we're in the midst of a big EU budget negotiation over the multi-annual financial framework for 2021 to 2027. And a big part of that debate is cohesion funding. But some voters, especially in Western Europe, don't really know much about how this works. And I know that in Greece, for a lot of voters, this is a very important issue. Could you maybe walk us through why cohesion funding is significant for your region?
Cohesion funding is significant because it helps EU member states to develop their infrastructure, to develop the way they function, and to make them become more modern and European in a way. What the main issue that should trouble us today is that cohesion can only be implemented through the regions and through the cities. And that's because, first, we are much closer to the people, so we know the needs that they have. Second, we know how to deal with the issues much quicker and efficiently than a central government. The third is because they trust us more, because that's the people they know better, the people they elect all the time, and the people that they can find very easily to discuss their problems. So, in my opinion, what we need to do here is, when it comes to cohesion, to involve the regional and local authorities much more in the whole process. And this doesn't only go for cohesion. This goes for all aspects of politics. We need to bring Europe closer to the citizens by using the strength that the regional and local authorities can bring to Europe and to the citizens.
Do you think that countries like Greece should be getting extra funding from the new EU budget to compensate for the role that they're having in taking in asylum seekers?
I think that the burden and the weight of this issue, of the immigration crisis, should be proportionate to all member states, EU member states. This is a European issue. It's not one, two or three countries issue. So we need to deal with that issue in a proportional way so that all the burden is divided equally according to what we can give to that issue.
Following Brexit, there's quite a big hole in the EU's finances. And that's a part of why the European Commission did propose in 2018 that in the future budget, there would be some reductions in things like cohesion policy overall, not for Greece necessarily. As the president of the European Committee of the Regions, what would you be advocating for as a solution? Do you think member states should step up and fill that hole? Do you think we should see cuts in different areas? How would you address the problem?
I would definitely not cut money, funds, from issues that affect people's lives, everyday life. For example, the funds that are allocated for the regions and for the cities in Europe are funds that are being all absorbed and that they go for public work that influence everyday people's lives. So these are important, not to be cut. There are needs for schools. There are needs for hospitals still in many countries. There are needs for roads that will help us be a commercial superpower. And there are needs that stems from the issues that citizens deal every day. So these kind of funds cannot be cut out.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your time.
That was Apostolos Tsitsikostas in conversation with Politico's Lily Beyer. And that's all we have time for on this episode of EU Confidential. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode, and don't forget to rate or review us as well. You can always send us feedback at podcast@politico.eu. Be on the lookout for a special edition of the podcast coming to you from the Munich Security Conference, which will be landing in your feed on Sunday. And next week is a special episode from that European Council summit on the multi-year budget. In other words, There'll be lots to listen to over the next week. I'm Andrew Gray in Brussels. Thanks to producer Christina Gonzalez, and thanks to you for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.